understand we have a quorum. I'm going to call the meeting of the Ag Committee to order. The hour has arrived, 1 p.m. on the 20th of January, 2021. Good afternoon, everyone. This meeting will be held in accordance with House Rule 10.01, which is posted online. Mr. Smith, would you conduct a roll call?
Representative Sundin is present. Representative Vang?
Present.
Vang present. Anderson?
Here.
Anderson present. Burkle?
Here.
Burkle present. Eklund?
Present.
Eklund present. Hansen R?
Hansen R present.
Hansen R present. Hansen J?
Hansen J present.
Hansen J present. Cleavorn?
Cleavorn present.
Lippert? He's not here yet. Lewick?
Lewick present.
Lewick present. Miller?
Present.
Miller present. Nelson?
Present.
Nelson present. Thompson? He was.
Thompson present.
There he is. All right, we have a quorum.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Smith. Seeing that we do have a quorum, we have the minutes of the previous meeting in front of us. Vice Chair Vang, what is your preference?
Move the adoption of the minutes for the meeting of January 13, 2021.
Hearing that motion, any questions or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Opposed? Thank you. We have confirmation of that. Today we're going to finish up the leftover items from last week, Minnesota, the Department of Agriculture interim update, and also hear from the Board of Animal Health on some of their interim activities. All of the presentations are sent to members ahead of time and are posted on the committee website. So feel free to use your raise hand option if you want to ask questions. Depending on the version of Zoom, it's located on the bottom of your screen, either in the reactions button or under participants. Before we start, let's welcome those who are watching live stream of this meeting as part of the Minnesota Farmers Union virtual lobby days here in January. So hearing that, will the Minnesota Department of Agriculture please continue with their updates, introduce yourself, Meg Moynihan, and continue.
Good Hello. Afternoon, Chair Sundin. Hello?
Yep, we're good. Thank good. You.
Good. Good afternoon, Chair Sundin, Vice Chair Vang, and members. For the record, my name is Meg Moynihan. I am a senior advisor at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and I really, on behalf of the department, appreciate your having us to speak about farm stress and mental health issues today. This is not the first time I've appeared before this committee, and I always find these conversations really stimulating and helpful as we think about how to support farmers and others involved in agriculture. With your permission, I think I'm going to turn off my video stream because I am one of those people with rural band with issues. And so I'm coming to you from a dairy farm in South Central Minnesota today. And I'd rather be able to you see the slides and hear me than see me. Today, I would like to give you a brief report on some selected efforts that we have been embarked on between March and December of 2020 related to our farm stress and mental health. And the items I'd like to cover with you today are our Minnesota Farm and Rural Helpline, the Rural Mental Health Specialists, our Farm Advocate Program, and a number of events and workshops we've held for professional development of agriculture and mental health provider communities and trying to provide better supports. I do want to say to you that this work is it occurs in the context of a great number of partnerships and collaborations across the state. Institutions and organizations like Farmers Union, like the Farm Bureau, like Extension, the Upper Midwest Center for Ag Safety and Health. And it is really collaborations that make this work.
Did we lose someone?
Tristan, Dean, I do not hear her as well.
Yeah, no, we're in trouble here. We can't hear the committee administrator either.
Ms. Moynihan, are you still on? It looks like we lost connection with her.
Okay, who do we have up next?
I'm back. I was trying to talk to you by phone. Are we okay?
Yeah.
Go ahead, please.
Okay, sorry. One of the things that I stress, I get calls from states like Pennsylvania, Virginia, Illinois, Wisconsin, asking about what we do here in Minnesota and how we do it so well. And one of the things I really emphasize to them is that we function very well in partnership with other groups and organizations. So the first thing I'd like to talk to you about is our Minnesota Farm and Rural Helpline, which is the next slide. That is a service that has been in existence for a number of years. And the innovation this year came from us noticing that we're having fairly moderate call activity, I would say between 3 and 12 a month on our 24-hour 800 number, which is staffed by professionals at a crisis response center. And at the same time, we noticed a great deal of traffic on our website. We have a companion website. And so in conversation with the call center, we decided to try adding text and email capacity so that people can use text and email in addition to calling this number. And it really exceeded my expectations. The month after we started this, we had 35 texts and 12 emails. And so I really think that by providing other methods of connection, we have opened up this service to people that perhaps we weren't reaching before. The image that you see on the screen in front of you is our wallet card that we make available, but we've also sent it out to groups and organizations as a drop-in graphic for their newsletters and their websites. And a lot of the commodity groups have gotten that out, the farm organizations have, and the partners have been really supportive that way. And I do want to mention that if members, Chair Sundin, of your committee have constituent newsletters and would be interested in including this graphic, either as a black and white or a color, we would be very happy to provide that to members and appreciate their help getting it out to their constituents. We want to move on to the next slide. Given the challenges that the entire state and no less the rural community has been under with COVID-19 and some of the implications of that, we invested some CARES Act money that we received through the legislature to really promoting our Minnesota Farm and Rural Helpline with a lot of energy behind that. We did a fall outreach campaign that we timed for after harvest and just as the holidays were onsetting. It's during harvest, everybody has the pedal to the metal and really isn't ruminating on a lot of things. But with the onset of holidays and short days and just the continued pressures that COVID is putting on families and businesses like farms, we felt that it was really important to make this available. So we did print ads in farm and ranch publications. You can see example of one of those on the screen. That was a full page ad that ran in a number of different publications, noting that translation is available. So if we had farmers or farm family members that are not native English speakers, they know that this service is available to them too, or they have farm workers. But we also did 30-second radio spots on three of the farm networks that cover pretty much the state of Minnesota. And so we're really pleased by the cooperation we had there. And then again, the in-kind partner outreach. Minnesota Corn Growers, for example, buys radio time weekly on several radio networks and would call me up and say, hey, Meg, would you like our 30 seconds this week? Would you like our minute this week for the, you know, the corn update? And so in kind of thus the opportunity to reach more of the agricultural community, which was really a boost. Could we go to the next slide, please, Nancy? I want to mention our rural health mental health specialists, who many of you know. They are funded by and have been for many, many years, passed through legislative funds that come through the Department of Agriculture and go to Minnesota State. Ted Matthews has been a rural mental health counselor for nigh on 20 years. He has testified before this committee. Until last fall, he was the only game in town, not last fall, but the fall before, he was the only game in town. And what these counselors do is they are available to farmers and farm families at no out-of-pocket cost, no insurance card required, no clipboard, no intake form. It's just getting together to have a conversation with a therapist. Many of their referrals come through the Farm Business Management Program. Many come from word of mouth. And they also get referrals from callers who call the Farm and Rural Helpline and the counseling center staff there. If they assess that this person needs some more intensive conversation or would benefit from therapy, they will refer to them. So Ted now, where he was the statewide person, he is covering for the most part the southern part of the state. And we have Monica McConkie, who is a licensed professional counselor, who handles by and large the north part of the state. But they each deal with clients in each other's territories, if you will. So that is something that is available to everybody. Some people might prefer to speak to a man counselor. Some people might want to speak to a woman counselor. They have those options. They tell me they have been quite busy. They are still doing a lot of work by telephone, but also in person. And both of them continue to meet in person with clients if that is something that the client prefers. And a lot of these farm families really prefer that. Both of them said while they use Zoom meetings, that's the minority of their interactions. And I talked to them quite extensively last week because I knew I was coming to visit with you about this. And both of them, the first thing they talked to me about was the fact that they're hearing a lot of hopelessness. And that's something that is just pervasive in the folks that they're talking to now. And some of these contributing factors around this circle are uncertainty and frustration with the way life is going, the direction. Both of them said, farmers and farm families don't appear to be afraid of getting sick from COVID-19, but there are a tremendous number of knock-on effects that are really having impact on their lives, their social lives, their emotional lives, their businesses, and that's what is contributing to the sense of hopelessness. Fear about the future, about what is going to happen, about some of the other factors that are happening in agriculture, some of the other contributing stressors, the production factors, the financial uncertainties, market uncertainties. Some of the protective factors are missing right now. Church is a big deal for a lot of farm families in rural communities. Sometimes church is not only a source of spiritual succor, but also emotional support and social interaction. Church is not happening in the same way. Schools are closed. Cafes are closed. Clubs are closed. Sometimes you can't get your tractor in for repair because the schedule has changed there, or they have repair people who are out. So those are all other challenges that are part of the balls that are in the air. And in general, both Ted and Monica tell me they're seeing a tremendous amount of family tension and are doing a lot of relationship counseling. Monica in particular is working with some youth, some farm kids. Ted, for his part, was very involved in his part of the state with the meat plant closures and the effects that those had on farm families that were faced with destruction of livestock. And he did quite a lot of counseling with the farms that were impacted, particularly with hogs and the hog depopulation. That is continuing to go on. And he said that he fully expects that there will be some post-traumatic stress disorder that takes a while to materialize. And every situation is unique, but that problem has not gone away. You know, that problem has a long tail. So that's another concern. Could we move on, Nancy, please? Minnesota Farm Advocates are another program with which a lot of you are familiar. These are 10, for the most part, retired farmers or retired farm business management professionals who are in position to advocate, really to be in the farmer's corner. They are not a neutral party. They are there to help farmers navigate difficult situations. Most of the time, these have been natural disasters and financial disasters. That is continuing. I've put on the slide a sense of the hours that these 10 individuals are putting in, not each, of course, but cumulatively. We meet with them once a month. The commissioner convenes meetings with this group, and we have been hearing quite a lot of conversation about foreclosure and bankruptcy, and they're very concerned about the financial situation of farms. They attend a lot of mediations to be there as a source of support with the farmers. They're concerned about how some of those are going, and they're also concerned about farmers' access to legal advice and whether there is enough of that in the countryside. They were super appreciative earlier this week when Representative Lippert attended the meeting to visit a bit about a bill that he's presenting, I believe, next week on farmer lender mediation, because that's a program that they're all really involved with. That is a program that is really a flagship for Minnesota. We're recognized for it. The commissioner refers callers to those farm advocates all the time, and he will tell you that he did that when he was the legislative director of Farmers Union and representing those members, and that has continued as a commissioner. He really has a lot of confidence in that group and the work they do on behalf of farmers. I think we can move along, and we will end up with my last slide here. I wanted to share with you a little bit of the work that we have done in professional development. Our view at the Department of Agriculture is that we are not the be-all and end-all. We don't have all the answers, and we also don't have everybody's ears. And the more we can do to engage a community, a responsive community that is out there supporting farmers in rural areas, the better off we all are. And so we have reached out and we target professional development training opportunities to agency staff, to extension, lenders, educators, social and human services, so kind of a non-traditional groups that aren't generally the audience of the Department of Agriculture, but really critical here, clergy, veterinarians. The first item on this list is a webinar that we did in May. And it came out of the stakeholder calls that the commissioner was holding every week during the COVID crisis, as we began to realize how serious the fallout effects were going to be from meat processing plant closures. And we began to really get a sense of the devastation that was going to happen in terms of the impact on farms with having to depopulate livestock. We put together a session that targeted mental health professionals and others who are kind of outside agriculture who would likely be confused about depopulation, why it was happening, things we were hearing about. You know, there are lines miles long waiting for food, and yet we hear farmers are plowing under tomatoes and dumping out milk and euthanizing hogs, and why are those selfish farmers doing that? Struggling with making sense of all of this. And so we really felt a need to explain kind of the life cycle of animals and what happens in terms of processing and the impacts that this was likely to have on farmers, farm families, farm workers whose life is invested in caring for these animals until they become a food product, but also consumers who weren't making sense of things. And we had really strong response from the mental health community. The Board of Animal Health helped us with that, as did one of our rural mental health specialists. So we were really pleased with the way that went. And that gave us some confidence to do more, shift more of our training opportunities online. The next two, Navigating Conflict and Supporting Farm Youth in Stress, are workshops that were supported by a USDA grant that we have. And we did those as in-person events around the state and regionally, the 6 or 8 months prior, and decided to move them online and make them available to more people, which actually attracted folks from across the country. It was fascinating. We had people from 20 or 25 different states tune in to find out what we were doing in Minnesota and to attend these learning sessions. So we were glad to be able to offer it more broadly, kind of reduce the time and cost of attending something in person. So finding that, I'm sure as your committee does, that you lose a lot by not being able to meet in person, but there are some things that you gain. So we tried to maximize the gain. Those were very successful and had between 200 and 400 attendees. And then in early December, we partnered with the Minnesota Department of Health's Suicide Prevention Program to offer an hour and a half webinar about bereavement in response to suicides and what happens after a suicide and what are the factors of grief and what are the expectations and the pressures and what are some of the challenges that families that may experience a suicide in a farming situation have that are a little bit unique. And that was another session that attracted people from all over Minnesota, but quite a lot of other states as well. And so we were tremendously pleased at how that went. And that was a great partnership for us to do with the Minnesota Department of Health. We have some more things planned with them and some other joint efforts with the Department of Human Services that I hope you'll have me back perhaps next year to talk about. So apart from the complaints about our webinar platform from participants, we had really strong positive feedback on all of those events and felt that was really important for us to be able to do and is going to have impacts in communities. So with that, Mr. Chair, that brings me to the end of the information that I wanted to share. If your committee has time, I'd be more than happy to answer questions. Really do appreciate you having me in today to talk about these issues.
Thank you, Meg Moynihan. I will start off with a word of appreciation for the work you do. Suicide prevention has always been an issue that I'm very interested in for a couple of different reasons. But I'm just wondering about your text line there. You said there's only a dozen or so per month that participated in that. Do you hire a service, a counseling service to answer those calls, or just briefly, what are the mechanics of that?
Mr. Chairman, we do and we always have hired an outside service, and currently we use a crisis service called First Call for Help Itasca, which is up in Itasca County, and answers crisis lines for a number of different entities. And in fact, they answer the National Suicide Prevention Helpline in Minnesota as well. So they are staffed by trained professionals. If they receive a call, a text, or an email that's related to something that a service we could provide at the Department of Agriculture, for example, it's somebody who wants information about finding an attorney, or it's somebody who wants information about loans that may be available, they sometimes refer the caller back to us. If it's somebody who is in a mental health crisis and needs ongoing support, they might refer them on to one of the rural mental health specialists.
Terrific. Thank you. We have a couple of hands up. I don't know who went up first. We can start with Representative Anderson, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Moynihan, thank you, too, for the work you do. A couple of quick questions. Following up on Chair Sundin's comment about the calls coming into services, you mentioned going to some texting and emailing. And those by themselves are really one-way conversations. How do you follow up with folks that would either send a text or an email and get back to them and keep that line of communication going?
Ms. Moynihan.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson. Thank you for the question. And I do want to say that I thought of you this morning when our milk pump failed, because I knew that as a dairy farmer, you would probably appreciate the stress that I was under. But to the point of your question, those can be one-way conversations. We, at the Department of Agriculture, we do not receive a lot of detail about those interactions simply because we want to respect the confidentiality of the person who is reaching out.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Representative Anderson?
Yeah, if we haven't lost her, just also wondering, you know, Ted Matthews has done a great job for so many years, and I know he's talked some of retirement. What is his future and he's going to be hard to replace. Any conversations about that? Ms. Moynihan.
Ms. Moynihan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I think I heard you asking about Ted. I would have to kind of refer to the Minnesota State System, who has the ongoing relationship with him. I know they're expecting that he will be retiring sooner rather than later. And there will be conversations about how to fill that position. I don't have any insights. I've not been party of any of those conversations to date. And I would imagine that Keith Olander or Brad Schlosser from Minnesota State would probably be very happy to come and have this discussion with your committee or with any of the members individually as well.
Yeah, he's been excellent. So hats off to him and the lady work with him too. And again, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We don't want to run up against the clock here. We have two more questions, and then any further questions on this topic will have to be submitted in writing. So please be concise with your questions and answers. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good to see you, Ms. Moynihan, and thank you for the work you do. You know, for the past several years, we've had questions kind of on the metrics of the data that are presented. Is it only farmers, or is it farm workers? And this is across the board, or is it rural people? And I understand the issues about depopulating the hogs, but I didn't hear you say anything about the workers that were affected with COVID at the plants. Is your service available for those workers who were experiencing great trauma as COVID swept through those plants very rapidly and in those communities where there may be families that are affected by that? So I understand the issue of confidentiality, but we're doing a great deal of effort, and I think tracking is very important, particularly when we may have a lot of people who could use the services, but if they are not actual farmers, if they are not being included in the opportunity for these publicly funded services. Thank you.
Ms. Moynihan, response?
Mr. Chair, I think we lost her for a second. I think she's back here.
I'm back, Nancy. Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, thank you for the question. I think we do a much better job getting the information out to farmers than we do to the rural community more broadly. We do call it the Minnesota Farm and Rural Helpline. Occasionally, we get a call from somebody who's rural, see come through that was not. But I think our outreach really emphasizes farmers. I think the question about farm workers is a good one. I know that when Ted was doing his on-site interactions, he was interacting with people, not only at the farms, but in the plants, as far as I know. And so I certainly could follow up with him and get some more information from you on that.
Thank you. I understand Representative Thompson has a question.
Thank you, Chair. Not a question, just a quick comment, if I could, to Ms. Monahan. I just wanted to say thank you for the presentation. And when you brought up mental health and suicide, it really, really like brought me to my knees because that resonates with me. And you did a beautiful job of bringing rural Minnesota and the effects that COVID is having to me, although we have no dairy farms in St. Paul that I know of. I had no idea that some of the things that you were talking about existed. And so I just wanted to say thank you because you changed my perspective. And a lot of times we perish from lack of knowledge. And a lot of these problems that are existing here, I'm quite sure a lot of people like myself didn't know. And so I want to say thank you because we do share the same problems. We just in different communities, and you've done a beautiful job of enlightening me on a lot of things that I didn't know. So I want to say thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Ms. Moynihan. I'm sure we're going to hear more from you as the year trudges on. Next up, we have hemp rulemaking and participation for about the next half hour. Let's hear from Assistant Commissioner Whitney Place.
Good afternoon, committee members. My name is Whitney Place. I serve as Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Nancy, are you running this slideshow?
Good question. Here we go.
Thank you so much.
Continue, please.
There we go. Okay, so today I'm just going to give a brief update on our industrial hemp program. We are still working on finalizing our 2020 growing season report, and so we'll have a more thorough information for you in the future, but I'm just going to highlight some of the regulatory things that have happened. So prior to 2016, industrial hemp is a crop that has not been grown in Minnesota since shortly after World War I. So bringing this new crop online, with it being so closely related to a controlled substance, has brought many regulatory challenges that we've had to figure out as a state agency. Now, the federal government has been working through that same process, and we're hoping to be under the new federal plan for the 2021 growing season. So just a bit of recent history for hemp regulations in Minnesota. In 2014, the Farm Bill was passed that allowed for states to develop pilot programs for industrial hemp. In 2015, the Minnesota legislature passed the Minnesota Industrial Hemp Development Act, which allowed our agency, the Department of Agriculture, to develop that pilot program. In 2018, the Farm Bill had additional hemp provisions in it, which included defining hemp as an agricultural crop. And it gave the federal government some regulatory authority. So states and tribal governments were to submit industrial hemp plans to USDA for approval and regulatory oversight. Late in 2019, the USDA issued their rule on that Farm Bill. We had some issues with it, and we were in close dialogue with USDA, but proceeded to negotiate a bill or a plan for the Minnesota hemp program, which was approved by USDA in July of 2020. So it's really kind of timely now that I wasn't able to present last week because this past Friday, USDA issued their final ruling on their federal rules for industrial hemp, which actually had a lot of changes in them that we were really asking for and looking for. And I'm proud to say that I think Minnesota was really a leader in the conversation in forming and shaping those federal rules. So we're really happy with where they're at right now. Those will go into effect in March. We do have to change and adapt our plan a little bit so that it is in line with those new federal rules, but we will be under the USDA approved plan in Minnesota for 2021. So the next step after getting that all approved will be to do state-level rulemaking. So we still haven't made rules for our state statute. So that's something that we will proceed with probably this year after USDA approves our plan. Nancy, you can advance to the next slide, please. So this is just a snapshot of the industrial hemp program since it's been in existence here in Minnesota in recent years. You can see there was a lot of growth in licenses until it sort of leveled off this past year. We are expecting similar acreage and applicants for the 2021 growing season as we had in 2020. Our application is currently open and will be closing on April 30th. At the department, we're really excited about building the industrial hemp industry. And to do that, we feel that we need to build processing capacity specifically for industrial hemp fiber and industrial hemp food products. We've had some really great partners in the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute, as well as the University of Minnesota, who continue to work on that basic and applied research that this new industry needs. We also have some really fantastic industry leaders who have a vision of what hemp could be in Minnesota. Companies are selling hemp food products like hemp hearts, hemp seeds, hemp oil, and even hemp protein burgers might be coming online in Minnesota soon. There are lots of fiber projects underway, including some new exciting construction applications. And it's also really exciting to see the different hemp projects that are taking place within tribal governments and tribal communities across the state. We're going to be holding a Minnesota Hemp Forum next month, February 10th and 11th. That will be an opportunity to look at all of these different issues and projects more in depth. And I'll be sure to send an invitation to all the committee members once we have the agenda for that finalized. So with that, that's kind of all the update that I have for now. And I'm happy to stand for any questions the committee may have.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Whitney Place. I really do appreciate it. You said about 83% of the crop is used for CBD production, which, you know, I've seen the product, I've used the product. It has some limited effects, you know, for aches and pains. How is the medical community weighing in on that, on CBD?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the moment, CBD is not something that is approved by the FDA for use as a food or drug. It does have approval, I think, for two different drug products now. But CBD, this has been one of the challenges with the industry. CBD is highly unregulated right now. In Minnesota, we did pass a statute, I think, in 2018. That gave the Board of Pharmacy some regulatory authority over different tinctures and supplements for CBD. But that's this big question mark. You know, the industry in Minnesota really exploded the past couple of years as in terms of CBD production and sales, but it is highly unregulated and it's just a big gray area right now, both at the federal and state level.
Okay. Thank you. I'm anxious to hear more as the days go by. Representative Vang has her hand up. Representative Vang, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Whitney, for the updates. I've noticed there's a huge increase for hemp grown for fiber. Can you explain or discuss why, what caused that to be? What made that jump?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Vang. As more fiber processing capacity comes online, we expect that number to go up a lot higher even than CBD. And frankly, we would like to see a lot of the acres for industrial hemp in Minnesota be grown for things like fiber. There are a couple of fiber companies coming online across Minnesota. They're in a lot of different regions. But they're all still starting up and trying to figure out, you know, how many acres do we need? How can we contract with farmers? And trying to find farmers, frankly, in their area that are growing hemp. So that's the reason we're hoping that it continues to increase.
Representative Vang, any follow-up?
Yes, and can you specify where these fiber processing companies are coming from? Is it local or is it from out of state?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Vang.
This place.
The processing facilities for fiber are mostly local. There are lots of different companies, especially in Canada, that are well established in the hemp industry. And so, you know, we do know of growers now that the 2018 Farm Bill passed and hemp can move across borders. We do know there are some sales going internationally as well. There are also some other states that are really invested in this industry, Colorado being one of them, where we know there's business being done across state borders.
Representative Vang, anything further?
Nope, that is all. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Good question. Representative Jess Hansen, please.
Thank you, Chair Sundin, and thank you for this presentation. I am very interested in hearing more about how this industry will continue to grow, so thanks for being here today. A couple of the questions that I had, as far as the increase in licensing numbers, do we have demographics as to who these licenses are going to and whether or not these are Minnesotans? I also have questions about equity, and are there equity goals as these licenses are issued? Or are there any particular campaigns or outreach efforts being made to ensure that these opportunities are being made aware to the entirety of Minnesota? Thank you.
Ms. Place.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jess Hansen. So the licenses that all of those licensee numbers are in Minnesota. So both the growers and the processors. You know, we run the program for Minnesota, and so it's the Minnesota jurisdiction. I will just add, I don't know if I made this clear before, that now with the new Farm Bill, tribal governments also are able to get their hemp plans approved by USDA. And so we do have two tribal governments in Minnesota who already do have their plans approved, and we have others who are looking into it. So, you know, we'll be doing the farmers that are not farming within tribal communities, and then we'll be partnering with the tribal community, you know, with all of this work. In terms of equity, this question has come up a lot with this program because I think hemp is seen as an opportunity for some of our emerging farmers. But data practice rules don't allow us to collect some of the demographic information that we need to collect to answer some of those questions while we're licensing. And so that would have to be some sort of, you know, survey or research that would be done on our licensees outside of the scope of our regulatory program. So I don't have a good answer for you on that. I will say that with a lot of our emerging farmer work within the agency, you know, we're trying to promote more of these new opportunities to new and beginning and emerging farmers. But I would say that the hemp industry is still quite new, and there's a lot of opportunity for growth in that area.
Anything further, Representative Hansen?
Yes, and thank you for that answer. I appreciate it, and thank you, Chair Sundin, for letting me follow up here. I guess when I ask the question about are these licenses going to Minnesotans, I'm asking because we know that there's an influx of money coming from out of state that may potentially be taking opportunities away from Minnesotans who have built their lives here, raising their children here. And so my question is, are we tracking how many of these licensees are moving here from out of state? Not that we aren't welcome to new business being invested in Minnesota. But that is a big conversation happening in this community is, are there folks who are bringing that money in and potentially, you know, saturating a market early on or things like that?
Ms. Place, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen. So I would say, you know, all of the grower licenses are definitely Minnesotans because somehow they have to have access to land. I guess there could be a land renter who would be growing hemp in Minnesota, but I'm pretty confident that most of the grower licenses would be Minnesotans. In terms of the company, kind of processing licenses. I would have to check with my staff, but you know, a lot of those licenses are the same person or the same entity. So you might have your grower license to grow the hemp, but then also have like a CBD extractor on your farm to process it. So there is a lot of like local, you know, economic development potential within this industry. I will say that, you know, as we look to other forms of cannabis sales, and we have seen in other states who have legalized recreational cannabis, we know there are a lot of bigger players in that space and a lot of bigger players who are waiting for states like ours to legalize. And, you know, I think that's something we talk about in that discussion, is how do we make sure that the wealth and the industry and the economic development is staying in Minnesota. But I think that's also something that we're looking at with industrial hemp, probably at a bit of a smaller scale. You know, I think at this moment, most of our processing facilities and businesses are local, but there is potential for us to be able to license someone in state who might be, you know, headquartered elsewhere.
Thank you very much. We need to move on to a couple more questions here. Representative Burkle, please.
Thank you, Chair Sundin. Hi, Whitney. How are you today? I got a question quick on industrial hemp in the feed industry as far as animal feed, livestock feed. Have you done any work with hemp seed meal in a feed, in a ration for poultry or for any kind of livestock?
Ms. Place?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Burkle, that's a really good question. And again, because I think the industry is a little bit out ahead of some of the regulations, hemp in animal feed is not actually approved at the federal level yet. So AFCO is required to do all of the, you know, trials and studies with each different species of livestock. And, you know, those trials are happening. Colorado is actually kind of taking the charge in supporting a lot of that work. We're trying to support as well. But we do have, in Minnesota, we do have our food and feed safety division, and you are able to label hemp products on feed in a way that doesn't, you know, show that there's any like nutritional gain or claim any like health benefits for it. But we're trying to get there as an industry so that it is a legal ingredient in livestock feed.
Thank you, Ms. Place. Follow up on that?
No, I'm good. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Burkle. Representative Thompson, please.
Thank you, Chair. Ms. Vivian. I guess my question is similar to Representative Hansen with regard to hemp, even in the medical cannabis. It seems almost like the African American community has been all but left out of production, farming, growing. We don't even own any land to grow any. So are you tracking that? And then I also wrote that there were 470 people growing, 580 applications. Are you tracking demographics as to why this population has been left completely out of this market?
Ms. Place.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, so I would completely agree with you on the fact that we don't have very many Black farmers in Minnesota, and that historically they've been, you know, left out of this industry. And you know, this is not just specific to hemp; it's the entire agricultural industry in general. And that is something that we take very seriously at the Department of Agriculture, and we're working closely with beginning and emerging farmers through our Emerging Farmer Work Group, in trying to break down some of the barriers to people of color and historically underserved people in this industry. In terms of the industrial hemp licenses, again, we're not allowed for data practices laws to collect some of those demographic data points that we need to be able to make some of those determinations. And so, again, you know, additional research would have to be done on the program and on the industry to suss out kind of, you know, what those demographic breakdowns are. I will say now that industrial hemp is considered a crop at the federal level, we're going to, you know, get a lot more research capability with that. So industrial hemp is now eligible for federal grants. And, you know, NAS and FSA will now be calculating and collecting data on industrial hemp. So that should show us a little bit more information over time about how the industry is growing.
Thank you. Any follow-up on that, Representative Thompson? Thank you for the questions. Thank you for the answers. I guess I really have one question for Ms. Place about the scale of what's going on there. You know, you've got the 500 plus people involved there. Are we talking a 10 acre plot? Are we talking 100 acres? Are we talking about a section of land? I know there's a lot of interest in this, but I'm just wondering, are we approaching profitability in the hemp field where this is going to be a large scale farming of any sort?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So it really varies depending on what you're growing hemp for. So if you're a CBD grower, you're growing a smaller amount of a really high value variety. And so those farms tend to be definitely under an acre, and some of them also take place indoors. The larger acreage is going to come from more fiber production. And so once we get more fiber processing capacity online, we expect the acreage for the program to really expand, because that's where you're going to see kind of the full section of growing of hemp, similar to some of our larger crops in Minnesota.
Thank you. Any further questions for Ms. Place? Okay, hearing none, thank you for your time today. Next up, we have the Board of Animal Health. So we'll hear an update on interim activity from Dr. Beth Thompson. And we'd like to finish up at 2:25. So Beth Thompson, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Beth Thompson, State Veterinarian and Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. I don't have a presentation today, but hopefully all of you did get a hold of the handout that we provided. It's a two-pager. I'll provide updates, just some verbal updates on comments on our response to COVID, and then also an update on our CERVID, which is deer and elk rulemaking, and my comments are just going to overlap with that handout for you guys. So 11 to 12 months ago, I remember first conversations with our employees. Now, we only have approximately 40 employees at the board, but we had started to hear about some of the COVID issues in some of the other states. And then it seemed like almost within days, I was telling our field staff they needed to be thrifty with their use of PPE. So PPE is personal protective equipment. That's the masks and the gloves, and for our folks wear coveralls and booties when they're out, especially when they're doing investigations into zoonotic diseases, those diseases that pass from animals to people, also with some of our foreign animal disease investigations. And then it seemed like we did just after that, we were telling our office staff that they needed to pick up their laptop computers and go home to work. So it was a little bit of an additional background. The board works with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture on foreign animal disease events. During those situations, like highly pathogenic avian influenza in 2014-15, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture stood up its incident management team. And that we call, we love abbreviations, so that's the IMT. And that team contains members of Department of Ag, the Board of Animal Health, Pollution Control Agency, and many other state agencies. So when COVID came to Minnesota, that IMT was quickly stood up, and Board of Animal Health staff were included in that IMT. And that quick response by the Department of Ag and others was really helpful for livestock producers and other domestic animals in the state of Minnesota. As you all are aware, and you know, some of the speakers here have been talking about it today, COVID created some significant delays in poultry processing, swine processing. You know, luckily in Minnesota, we didn't see the dumping of milk that ended up happening in some of the other states. I think it got to as close to us as Wisconsin. And our beef farmers weren't as affected because those folks, those farmers and ranchers, can hold on to their animals before they go into processing. But some swine and poultry production is on some really, really tight and really specific schedules. So the slaughter plant slowdowns were really challenging. And once schools and restaurants started shutting down or cutting back, the food industry had to quickly pivot and switch to different types of production. And it's also my understanding that some items, such as, you know, like packaging for liquid eggs, became in short supply because some of that was being redistributed to other parts of our economy. But working together with the Department of Agriculture and that IMT, that incident management team, we made resources available for our farmers. Daily conference calls, updated information via websites, all of this virtual life that we have that became very important in the COVID climate. So the Board of Animal Health does not have jurisdiction to oversee depopulation procedures of healthy livestock. We really come into play when there's a disease. But we do have some regulation and oversight of mortality disposal due to non-disease causes. We also license rendering companies within the state. So we work closely with those companies on an ongoing basis. While I doubt that any of the rendering companies are going to be listening into this hearing right now, I do want everyone to be aware that they really, really stepped up and they really helped out when it came up, you know, with that capacity to assist poultry and swine with some of that disposal that was needed. And coordination of that rendering information, who the companies are, the contact information, all of that was on our website, along with a lot of information about carcass disposal sites that were set up by the Department of Agriculture. So back to, I'm following through here on some of the handout, back through some of the other bullet points on that handout. The board worked with the Department of Agriculture to provide mental health resources to veterinarians, producers, industry. One of the previous speakers, Meg Moynihan, is such an important state resource, along with Mr. Matthews and Ms. McConaughey. We at the board still hear accolades for those folks and everything that they did over the last 10, 11 months. We also worked with our colleagues nationally to share experience, insight, gleaned. Fortunately or not, Minnesota was one of the first states that was engaged in mass depopulation of livestock. All state veterinarians belong to an organization known as USAHA, the United States Animal Health Association. And because Minnesota is number two swine producing state, we were already working on some foreign animal disease response for African swine fever, and I'll be talking to you guys about that probably in the future. But as a group, those state veterinarians, we turned those weekly ASF calls into daily COVID response calls, invited in the federal agencies, and we also invited in state and national pork producer groups. A lot of this was also going on the poultry side too. There was a lot of communication that was going back and forth. So one last point that I do wanna make that's not on your handout, I think most of you are aware, but one of our major hog slaughtering plants in Minnesota, while it was shut down with the worker sickness that was going on within the plant actually kept its stun and kill line open. So even though the food process wasn't able to continue because the plant had shut down, they did have that stun and kill line open so that some Minnesota hog producers could use that to get their hogs euthanized. So the board worked as a liaison in that process. I was invited down to see the process right after it was stood up. And you know, I was standing there. It was just kind of surreal. I was standing there by a swine veterinarian that I've known for years. And he said to me, you know, my job is to keep those pigs healthy so that they can become food for somebody. And here we were, that we were watching the pigs being stunned and killed. And instead of going into food processing, those pigs were going into a rendering truck. So it really was an unbelievably devastating experience for many people out in Minnesota. So in addition to the plant shutdown response, we also tackled several other challenges related to COVID. And again, I'm gonna, if you look at your handout, we contacted veterinarians and clinics throughout the state to provide safe operating guidelines so that they could continue to provide essential services for animals. And we know that Minnesotans love and treasure their family pets. And don't be surprised if you see, I've got a black cat that's just ready to pounce here. But we collaborated with the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association, the Department of Health, and the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Board on putting together guidelines for small animal clinics and you know, people such as pet groomers to make sure that the people and the pets were remaining safe. We also worked with livestock auctions to get them the guidance that they needed so that they could continue to operate. We know smaller farms especially rely on livestock markets throughout Minnesota to buy and sell animals. And it was important to keep those markets up and running. And we also coordinated with county fairs and exhibitions. Of course, our state fair was canceled this year, but we did, you know, a lot of those picked up on the virtual showing of animals. So some students, some kids got to participate. Well, it wasn't in person, but they got to do something with those animals that they had. And then lastly, we continue to work with the Minnesota Department of Health to provide information to veterinarians about when to test cases for suspect COVID. I was just on a call with the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, yesterday. And in addition to companion animals, if you all know, the CDC is reporting COVID positive in mink, in large cats, in other species. Just within the last few days, a paper came out of reporting COVID susceptibility in white-tailed deer fawns, and that's coming out of researchers from the National Veterinary Services Lab down in Iowa. So a lot of work is continuing in domestic animals. So overall on that subject, I hope you all realize the board staff filled in where, you know, the gaps that were forming, we tried to fill in those gaps. And we're hoping that our assistance in filling in those gaps with Department of Health, Department of Agriculture, and other were both meaningful and helpful. And then just quickly, Chair, our CERVID rulemaking timeline. Again, I'm going to refer to our handout. Based on the changes made in 2019 to Chapter 35, the board began the rulemaking process in 2020. The request for comments was published on June 29th of 2020. We then formed a 15-member advisory committee to participate in that revision process. And the group has been started meeting in August. They continue to meet now. A lot of the meeting minutes and that information is also on our website. The first comment period closed October 30th of 2020, and it is our goal to publish the notice of intent to adopt early in 21. We do need a revisor's copy to be able to do that. The revisor's office has to go through that final draft, and as we all know, they're busy right around these times, so we'll probably be waiting some time for that. Then there will be a second comment period that will open up, and the minimum length for that comment period is 30 days. If people are interested, all of the different drafts that we've gone through with the CERVID rules is on our website, and you can read through those and look through the changes that we've made. We've had several public listening sessions. Kudos to our staff for staying up a little bit past usual time and having them at night and trying to get the members of the public involved. We've also stood up a couple of listening sessions with the tribal organizations, the tribes, and some member groups. And that has led to the Board of Animal Health, the Department of Agriculture, and the Department of Natural Resources all coming together with tribes and tribal groups to discuss some of the concerns of those groups. And that's been worthwhile, I think, for all of us. I'm really, really grateful to Department of Agriculture, Department of Natural Resources, allowing us as a very small agency to utilize their tribal liaisons. And hopefully there are some good aspects that are going to be coming out of those meetings too. So with that, Mr. Chair, members, I'm open for any questions that you all may have. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your input today. We do have a couple of questions. Representative Vang, you have the gavel for a few minutes. I've got a delivery of a quarter of a beef knocking on my door right now, so I'll be back in a couple of minutes. Representative Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. See, some questions are raised. So Representative Jenny Cleaveland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My questions are maybe just twofold, but they're very different. When you were talking about the mental health supports that were being offered early in the depopulation, were those mental health supports also offered to the workers who were doing that depopulation work?
Representative Vang, Representative Cleaveland, thank you for that question. And I think Meg Moynihan probably covered some of the aspects of that. We were just, as Meg mentioned, I presented on one of the informational seminars for other workers, other people, other organizations. If I remember correctly, I think Meg said that there was some work done by Ted Matthews with some of the workers, but that's actually housed in the Department of Agriculture. We were just called on to provide some information for those seminars.
Thank you for that clarification. This is Representative Cleaveland again. I was actually referring to when you went out to the kill and stun facilities where that work was being done, but I appreciate the answer and response that you gave. This is building on the last point that you talked about now with the idea that it's possible maybe for COVID to go between species. When we were doing all of the kill and stun work and depopulation work, at any point in time, did anybody do random testing to make sure that the people who were doing the depopulation work were not at risk for COVID from the actual work itself?
Dr. Thompson?
Yes, Representative Vang, Representative Cleaveland. If you're talking about specifically on farm with the farm workers doing the depopulation, I am not aware of any organized effort to take COVID samples from the workers that are out on those farms. I would, however, suggest that maybe Department of Health would be a good go-to for that question. They might have some more information that I don't have. But I Board of Animal Health was not tracking that information.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, I wasn't very clear. I was referring to samples on the animals, not on the humans.
Oh, sure.
Dr. Thompson?
Yes, Representative Vang, Representative Cleaveland, I apologize, maybe I misunderstood the question. So specifically when the depopulations were going on in Minnesota, I'm not aware that anybody was taking samples from those animals. However, research has shown that the usual livestock species such as cattle, hogs, and others, it doesn't appear that COVID is, they're likely susceptible to COVID. Some of the susceptibility that we're seeing higher, it would be in mink, in cats and dogs. and some of those species. But yeah, there has been research done on the usual livestock species, and they just don't seem to be susceptible.
Thank you very much. Okay. No, thank you. And then Representative
Eklund. thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Thompson. So this is on a survey issue. A couple of questions. First off is, I'm assuming that all available science has been used when incorporating this proposed rulemaking on survey farms.
Dr. Thompson.
Representative Vang, Representative Eklund, I believe that the rules represent and reflect the known research at this point in time, and certainly are open for comments on those. We did push, or have been pushing, some of the drafts over to the University of Minnesota. In addition to that, the assistant director that's in charge of that procedure, what we're going through with the current rules, has been in contact with service staff at the United States Department of Agriculture, those folks that are running research at the federal level. In addition to that, she's also involved in we've got some other involvement in national research groups. So yes, I would say that it reflects the research as it is available at this point in time.
Follow up, Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Thompson. So I assume then that when we see the proposed rulemaking come out, Dr. Thompson, that there will be mention that prions and live 5 years or more, I don't know if that's the right word, survive in the soils for 5 years or better.
Dr. Thompson?
Representative Vang and Representative, thank you for that question. The rules themselves don't reflect that prions live in the soil for more than 5 years. That would be more of a statement. There is information within the rules dealing with different timelines, and we are following the USDA guidelines on those timelines at this point in time.
Representative Eklund, do you have any further follow-ups?
One or two more follow-ups, Madam Chair, if you'll indulge me. Thank you, Dr. Thompson. And probably my last question is, I was pleased to hear you talk about the cooperation that you've had with the DNR and the Department of Ag and the tribal governments and that sort of thing. In this time of COVID, how are we dealing with a survey farm that does come up with chronic wasting disease? And is that same type of cooperation extended as far as access to the farm so all procedures can be checked?
Dr. Thompson?
Representative Vang, Representative Eklund, thank you for that question. It is my understanding that all of the inspections, for example, on Cervidae farms in 2020 were completed by the end of the calendar year. Having said that, there were certain times during the middle of the year where our inspectors weren't doing as many as they normally do, but there we had a protocol for our inspectors before they would go out to any farm, call ahead, make sure that nobody is ill, wearing masks, all of those different items that all of us have been doing. And then, of course, once they get on the farm, making sure that they're socially distancing. The very important things that the Minnesota Department of Health has put out for all of us to follow. So hopefully I'm answering your question. I think I am. But as far as I understand, we did complete all of the Cervidae inspections for farm Cervidae farms. Oh, and I guess you did ask about whether if anything was found with CWD, that the protocol would remain the same. It would still be the people wearing masks and calling ahead and making sure that people staying home if they're ill and not going to someplace if there are folks there that are showing clinical signs of COVID.
One follow-up, Madam Chair, just quickly.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. Thompson. I appreciate that all the protocols are being followed by, as issued by the Department of Health. I guess my real question, or the question that I'm asking is the interagency relationship there where if a positive is found, positive CWD is found on a Cervidae farm, that all the agencies are involved in the follow-up on that?
Dr. Thompson?
Representative Vang, Representative Eklund, yes, we continue to communicate with all agencies, even though there is a human pandemic going on. I'm understanding your question correctly. When folks do find a positive on a farm, and that result comes to us from the veterinary diagnostic lab in St. Paul, that information is shared with us. It is then, of course, shared with the producer. At the same time that suspect comes out of the University of Minnesota, a quarantine is placed on the farm. And then that information is also shared out with the Department of Natural Resources. This is even happening prior to any public information being pushed out via a release, a press release, or anything along those lines. So that part of it hasn't changed because we do have COVID.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. Thompson.
Okay. I see that Mr. Chair has returned, so I'll return the gavel to Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Vang. I see Representative Paul Anderson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to visit with you, Dr. Thompson. My question is a bit of on a different topic. I've heard a few reports this winter of some low pathogenic bird flu among some turkey flocks. Is that kind of a normal occurrence in the wintertime? You know, also hearing that there's some over in Europe and the flight paths for waterfowl and ducks, there could be some concern. What are your thoughts as we head into late winter and spring with this low pathogenic bird flu, and what do you see ahead?
Ms. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, you are correct. There has been and continues to be some influenza that we're finding, especially west of the Twin Cities and then south and north a little bit from those lines. It is not those strains that concern us, and that would be the H5 and the H7. This is a different strain. It is a strain that's being identified by the National Veterinary Services Lab as being endemic in the wild waterfowl population. I can also tell you that the strain is not causing major clinical signs, so there aren't mortality events. We don't have, birds dying because of it. But because the poultry industry is fairly progressive, what they have done is stood up surveillance testing before they move their poultry. And a lot of this is being caught on those tests that are being done before the birds get moved out of their barns, either into another barn or into the slaughter channels. So that's how we're finding out about it. The board does not quarantine or do anything with these test results, again, because it's not an H5 or an H7. And for members of the committee, we become very concerned when we see H5s and H7s, because those are the viruses that can quickly change into a high path avian influenza. Again, low path, we see them around. We have cases of low path avian influenza in the state of Minnesota, probably yearly, every other year. High path avian influenza kills the birds, and that's what we saw in 2014 and 15. So, Representative Anderson, yes, there are cases out there not causing clinical signs. There are some of those cases also being seen in some other states. We have a real concern coming up this year. It looks as though we may be setting up with the cases across the world to see some high path here in the United States. Yeah, I don't have a map to show all of you, but when wild waterfowl in the summer or in the spring and in the winter move to their sites for mating and for overwintering, waterfowl will mix and match. And, you know, some of those wild waterfowl will come back down and fly over Europe. Some of them will come down and they'll fly over the Mississippi River Valley. Some will fly down over the western part of the United States. But for a period of time, they've all been in the same area up in the northern part of our hemisphere. And so they switch around viruses, and that's when you get to see some of these high-path avian influenza viruses, like they're seeing right now over in Europe especially.
Okay. Thank you, Doctor, and let's hope and pray that we don't see that in Minnesota.
Yes, I'd appreciate that.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you, Ms. Thompson. That was a terrific presentation. We're gonna be ending on time, maybe a little bit early, but please examine the committee rules that were provided to members and staff. We're gonna be using that 24-hour rule for amendments. With a little bit of an extension, I guess it would be called asking for amendments by 4 p.m. the day before, 4 p.m. on Friday for Monday meetings. Contact Ms. Connolly with any questions. And we want to ensure that the presentations and written testimony are more accessible to all members of the public. So there's a provision about using OCR formatted documents. So please pay attention to that as we move forward. We are adjourned. Thank you.